So this is Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Leela, chapter 9 and verses 175 to 178. So we'll just read the translations for 175 onwards, and then we'll do the full verse 178. This is 175. In Sri Shaila, Lord Shiva and his wife Durga lived in the dress of Brahmanas. And when they saw Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they became very pleased. Lord Shiva, dressed like a Brahmana, gave alms to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and invited him to spend 3 days in a solitary place. Sitting there together, they talked very confidentially. After talking with Lord Shiva, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu took his permission to leave and went to Kamakoshri Puri. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda ki. And then we come to today's verse. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu arrived at southern Mathura from Kamakoshri, he met a Brahmana. Purport. Southern Mathura, presently known as Madurai, is situated on the banks of the Bhagai River. This place of pilgrimage is specifically meant for the devotees of Lord Shiva. Therefore, it is called Shaiva Kshetra. That is the place where Lord Shiva is worshipped. In this area, there are mountains and forests. There are also two Shiva temples. One is known as Rameshwar, and the other is known as Sundareshwar. There is also a temple to Devi, called the Meenakshi Devi Temple, which displays very great architectural craftsmanship. It was built under the supervision of the kings of the Pandya dynasty. And when the Muslims attacked this temple, as well as the temple of Sundareshwar, great damage was done. In the Christian year 1372, a king named Kampanna Udayara reigned on the throne of Madurai. Long ago, Emperor Kulashekhar ruled this area, and during his reign he established a colony of Brahmanas. A well-known king named Anantaguna Pandya is an 11th generation descendant of Emperor Kulashekhar. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Ajnani Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishnaya Bhutale Shpateradana Swami Nitti Namine. So this is the continuation of the Lord's transcendental travels. And as we know, Lord Chaitanya undertook a series of pilgrimages during his time here. And this is his journey to the south, Dakshin, to the south part of India. And of course, he has many adventures on the way. And here we hear about some important places that he visited. Of course, just prior to this part, he had been interacting with Paramananda Puri. And he had asked Paramananda Puri to go to Jagannath Puri and to stay there, and that the Lord himself would come there just after he had visited different places in South India. After Rameshwaram, he promised he would go to Jagannath Puri, which of course then became his official residence during his sannyas period. So these places are very interesting. And what's interesting is the connection with Lord Shiva also. Here we get a little glimpse into the character of Lord Shiva, which is quite rare, but is very much relished by the devotees. And this is that, as it's described here, Lord Shiva and his wife Durga lived in the dress of Brahmanas. So Lord Shiva is a very, very powerful personality. He is extremely powerful and is a great devotee of the Lord. Vaishnavanam yatha shambhu, as the Bhagavatam explains. But Lord Shiva desires nothing but the service of Lord Krishna, ultimately. And this is an interesting item of Lord Shiva's character. We have to understand something about Shiva Tattva in order to understand their mood. During Krishna Leela, Lord Shiva desperately wanted entrance into those pastimes of Krishna. And different pastimes took place where he had to take a form of a gopi, and we get an idea that the pastimes of Lord Krishna, Lord Vishnu are supremely relishable to all, relishable for all, and especially for Lord Shiva. Because he is, after all, the topmost of the Vaishnavas, and he demonstrates what is the mood and sentiment of a Vaishnava. So here you have Lord Shiva and his wife Durga, who is herself the superintendent of this entire material world, extremely powerful, and they take the humble dress of brahmanas. Now, brahmanas don't dress in royal finery or regalia. They dress in simple dhotis, simple loincloths, simple chadars, nothing very elaborate, and they engage in pure, focused worship of the Supreme Lord. That is the trait and the activity conducted by the brahmanas. So they took this humble form, and they took the opportunity to serve Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is himself Krishna, Lord Krishna, who comes in this special form just in order to teach and to propagate the chanting of the holy name in this world. So when they met Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they offered him some alms, which would be the custom. When a householder meets a renunciate or a sannyasi, they would offer some alms, or indeed a saintly person in general. And they had some confidential discussions with him. We can only imagine the types of discussions that would take place between Lord Shiva and Lord Krishna. We can take a guess as to maybe the types of discussions that took place between Srila Prabhupada and his leading disciples, like Tamal Krishna Maharaj and others who Prabhupada considered to be his soldiers in carrying out this mission. And we can similarly try to guess the discussions that take place at the top levels of society. And we can only imagine what Lord Shiva and Lord Krishna, in his form as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, spoke about. But we can understand that there was clearly some great devotional subject matter that was discussed. And therefore it is said that sitting there together for 3 days, they talked very confidentially. Because the discussions amongst exalted persons, no less the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and no less the form of Lord Vishnu, which is basically Lord Vishnu as Lord Shiva, but just in a special form for interacting with the material energy, what types of discussions they have. And so these talks took place over 3 days. And this was part of Lord Chaitanya's intention in beginning this pilgrimage. Now, pilgrimage is something that everyone likes to do. But we'll learn actually through these verses today what the mood and what the purpose of it is. And so after this conversation, which took place over 3 days, it says that Lord Chaitanya went to Kamakoshtipuri, and there isn't much information given about that, but then he travelled from that place onwards to southern Mathura. Now, southern Mathura is the name given to a place which is now called Madurai. And this is a very, very famous place of Lord Shiva. So we have Mathura in the north, which is a very, very important place, and this was considered the counterpart in the south, and is called Madurai. Lord Shiva had blessed this place when the city was being set up. And in this place, Madurai, there is a famous temple that Srila Prabhupada refers to, the Meenakshi temple. Now, Meenakshi is the name of Parvati, Lord Shiva's consort, Durga Devi. And so she is worshipped there, along with Lord Shiva, who is known as, in this case, Sundareshwar. And so both of them are worshipped together. And the other place that is mentioned is Rameshwaram, which is near the place where Lord Ram began the construction of the bridge to go to Lanka. So these are places where Lord Shiva is worshipped, and they are of great importance for Lord Ram's pastimes as well. So in this place, Madurai, this temple is there, and this Meenakshi Devi temple is just like in Jagannath Puri, and maybe in Mathura in the past, or in Dwarka. It is a temple city, where basically the life of that city is centered around the temple. Of course, when someone speaks of Jagannath Puri, we immediately think of the Jagannath Puri temple. Then we know how the whole town is constructed around it, and how all the activities of all the residents are focused, or are supposed to be focused, on the worship of the Lord in some way or the other. And so this temple, Meenakshi Devi, has some exquisite architecture, colorful architecture, many, many pillars. and large features which are nice to see. So if you ever get a chance to go on pilgrimage to Madurai, to the south, there are many, many nice places to see, where you'll see Lord Shiva worshipped in a very great way, to a high standard, and Parvati as well. And so Lord Chaitanya was passing through Madurai, and then he went to Rameshwaram, and there in Rameshwaram, of course, there's that other Shiva temple that I mentioned. And interestingly, Prabhupada says that both of these temples were ransacked by the invading Mughals, roughly in the 13th century. So this original temple in Madurai, they say, is from about the 6th century. And there was something there from a long, long time prior to that. But then there was a large amount of damage done in the 13th century. And so the present structure has been rebuilt roughly around the 16th century by a king. And Prabhupada mentions this special emperor, Emperor Kulashekhar. And Kulashekhar wrote the Mukunda Mala Stotra, very, very wonderful devotional poem, which Vaishnavas love. But we can get a little understanding as to his mentality and mood. He would, in his court, he would hear every day the recitation of the Ramayana. He would have different court pundits and others reading that to him, his supporters. So one day it came to the discussion was going on, and they had been hearing about how Mother Sita had been kidnapped, the kidnapping of Mother Sita. Now when King Kulashekhar heard the pastimes of the Lord, he wasn't just listening to them as a storyline, as a story or a pastime that took place somewhere. He actually immersed himself in those pastimes at that moment. He was actually right there in that story as he was hearing it. And so when he heard that Mother Sita has been kidnapped by this heinous person, Ravana, he immediately started running towards the ocean and ran into the ocean and said, "Today we are going to invade Lanka. We are going to ransack the place. We're going to kill Ravana. We're going to rescue Mother Sita and we're going to come back." And he was deadly serious. His courtiers and everyone else was watching in amazement as he went into the water, started wading in, and he was about neck high, and he was about to start swimming. And he was thinking, "I will swim all the way to Lanka and make sure that Mother Sita is not harmed in any way." And so this was his mood. Now, of course, Lord Ramachandra, who was his supreme deity, saw all this mystical pastime going on and thought, "I better do something, because otherwise my poor devotee is going to be in a lot of trouble." And he's trying to encourage all his courtiers and the kings and the soldiers, the assistants, to come. So Lord Ram appeared right in front of him. Imagine in the ocean, you're swimming in the ocean, and Lord Ram appears with Mother Sita right in front. And he says, Lord Ram said, "Today is a great day, my dear king, because today we have rescued Mother Sita. We have been victorious. Ravana is dead. Lanka is finished, all his soldiers are destroyed. So let's go back and be peaceful." So it said he personally took King Kulashekhar's hand and brought him right back to the shore. And then at some point he disappeared, because the Lord's pastimes as Lord Rama are not meant to be taking place at this point in time. That happened earlier in Treta Yuga. But we see here actually the depth of devotion that the devotees of the Lord can have for the Lord, and how the Lord reciprocates with that depth of devotion. It's easy sometimes to speak about these topics, but they describe matters which are the confidential privilege of the great devotees of the Lord. We get a hint. But if tomorrow we start running into the ocean or start running into the lake here at the manor, thinking that Lord Ram is on the other side and Sita needs rescuing, that maybe it would be a little bit presumptuous. We actually, to develop such a mentality requires an in-depth development of character. It requires practice. It requires a development of bhav, a development of an unquestioned feeling for the Lord that doesn't arise so casually. Here in this world, we have so many occupations in our mind. On a daily basis, we are concerned with so many items related to the body. Then so many items related to extended bodies around us, our families, then our colleagues at work, members of society, in a state, so many different groups, people in the village, people in the town, persons that we interact with, persons at school. They form extended bodies that we interact with, and their concerns relating to their body and mind become our concerns. So bodily focus is a preoccupation for almost every one of us throughout most of the day. Now that is one thing. And then to some degree, we accept the worship of Krishna somewhere along the way. For some portion of our mental facility we give to Krishna, to meditating on Krishna, to worshipping Krishna. Some portion of our time we give to worshipping Krishna, hopefully. It's a portion. It's not a full reality. If our agenda for the majority of the day is the welfare of the body, our own body, and I include the mind in this, the body and the mind, the gross and subtle bodies, we preoccupy ourselves with the worship of our body and the assistance of others' bodies, which are all temporary. And any agendas connected to them are also temporary. Then what can we actually say is our development of bhav for the Lord? Real spiritual feelings for the Lord arise when there is a detachment from worldly affairs. That does not necessarily mean a detachment from worldly activities, but it does mean a detachment from the principle that in this world, the activities of the world are the prime goal. It does require a complete detachment from that principle. Now, why do I say not necessarily the activities? Because while we're here in this world, we have to engage in activities. We have to engage in activities that deal with this body. We have to engage in activities that deal with others' bodies. Wife, children, family, relatives. All of that has to be dealt with. But it doesn't have to be dealt with as the preoccupation in our lives. Knowing full well that it is temporary and that it will perish. And that at most every person here has maybe 70, 80, 90, 100 years if you're lucky. Well, what about the lifetimes that this spirit soul, the jiva, that is actually our real identity, has been traversing this world? What about the needs of that jiva? If our entire life is simply focused on the body, which is a vehicle, yantra rudhani mayaya, which will be left behind, left for consumption by the insects, birds, depending on the tradition. The Parsis do that, right? When someone dies in that tradition, they actually leave the body on a hilltop so that the living entities can eat it. Different traditions are there. With the animals, you see it all the time, right? It's there. You see roadkill on the side, then some fox is trying to eat it, the crows are pecking at it. Nothing to be particularly proud of. Prabhupada rather unglamorously describes the body as a bag. And each person has a different kind of bag. And sometimes I like to say that sometimes, you know, you see people parading down the street, showing off to their neighbors the latest bag they're carrying. Maybe someone wants to show off the Selfridges bag or the Harrods bag or some others. Someone's carrying a Primark bag. And so we have different bags in this world. And each of the bodies are similar to that, actually. Someone's got a Primark bag. Someone's got a Harrods bag. And we strut around in this world very proud of the particular bag we're carrying. Some bags are particularly strong. Some are biodegradable. Anyway, we won't take this analogy any further. But you can see that ultimately that's all it is. It's a vehicle, it's a container for the soul. And when you analyze it, it's nothing particularly glamorous because throughout the day it gives us so much trouble. A little dose of pleasure and so much trouble. And whatever aspects of this bag we don't possess at the moment, we try to acquire them through different treatments and different prayers even sometimes, and different efforts, and this and that. But really, it should not be the preoccupation of ours. Because there is something that we are far better suited for. Our real nature is the spirit soul. And yes, we have this body, we have this apparatus. It's a very elaborate apparatus. Let's use it healthily. Let's not contaminate it by items that will simply destroy it. Let's have healthy, wholesome foodstuffs. Let's lead a life which is simple in principle so that we do not give so much stress to the mind and intelligence on an everyday basis. That itself is a cause of many diseases. When someone is mentally unhappy in constant anxiety and constant stress, that actually gives rise to physical diseases because the body is not in a state to be able to deal with anything that arises. It's a fact. And mental disease in today's day and age is becoming the number one item that doctors have to deal with. Before it was cancer, heart disease. Yes, these are still there and probably increasing also because of all the artificial things we do to ourselves. But mental disease is also increasing. And for someone suffering through that, it's very traumatic, very difficult. Just as much troublesome as having a bodily disease. So we have, we can see that our lifestyle in this world actually causes us a lot of trouble on an individual daily basis because we don't have a focus in this world. So actually when we read scripture, when we read the Bhagavad Gita, when we read Srimad Bhagavatam, we actually receive some knowledge, some information of a different method of consciousness, a different focus for our consciousness that can actually give us a healthy, purposeful life, which allows us to receive everything we want. As Prabhupada indicates, that when we worship Lord Krishna, all aspects of our life become satisfied. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha. All of these components are satisfied when we worship Lord Krishna. Because Lord Krishna is the source of all happiness, the source of all pleasure. Who is the consort of Lord Vishnu? Lakshmi Devi. Everyone is striving hard for money, trying to acquire money by illicit means, questionable means, wholesome means. But Lakshmi Devi is the consort of Lord Vishnu. And when Lord Vishnu is worshipped, when Krishna is satisfied, Lakshmi Devi appears in whatever level is required for that person's devotional progress. So there's no need for us to consider that an alternative hedonistic, degraded lifestyle of simply acquiring more and more and more is actually an indicator of progress for human society. Actually, it's said, you know, the famous saying that, well, it's often repeated in many different places and by different people, that someone who is actually wealthy isn't someone who possesses a lot. Because as we all know, those possessions can decrease, right? Someone may be very proud of their extremely large bank account, but that can also disappear quite quickly. A few mistakes in how that's invested can cause that all to disappear. If the economic systems decide to freeze your bank account for whatever reason, well, it's of no use whatsoever. And ultimately, lots of money in the bank, you can't really eat it directly either. So if you're really hungry, it's only useful in its transactional ability to give you things that you actually need. So it's a shame that we've developed an overt preoccupation with this. Everyone needs sufficient funds, sufficient clothing, shelter, food to survive. But it should not become the preoccupation of our lives. Why? Because Lakshmi is chanchala. She's by nature chanchala. She moves from one person to another. She's transacted from one interaction to another. Nothing permanent. So given that all of these are permanent, these are temporary items, which are the opposite of permanence, the encouragement is that we shouldn't engage too much of our effort in them. And therefore we try to do the real work, which is the internal work, to actually purify our consciousness from the propensity to keep attaching itself to things that are temporary. This is why every morning we discuss these matters in the Bhagavatam class. Because inevitably, as soon as the day begins, our mind will naturally be engaged in mundane matters again. The education of the kids, the next holiday we're going to go to, how to acquire more money, dealing with the leak in the house, what's the weather like today, my relative wants this, my boss at work wants this. These are all very important, necessary things, but they're not of ultimate importance. That's my point. And they can occupy our mind continuously for an entire lifetime. And at the end of our lifetime, what do we have? We have a record of engagement in material activities from day one till the end. No progress. Which means as a result, next life will bring us something different. It'll bring us a different opportunity in a different body to now do some of the things we regretted not doing in this life. Some of the desires that were unfulfilled. Because we never fulfill our desires. And after fulfilling one desire, we then create another one. And so if you think for a moment, all the desires in your life that you fulfilled, did that stop you having more desires? No one can honestly say that your desires for more of the same have stopped. And this is the infectious nature of material interactions. The more you get, the more you want. And Ravana typifies that. That he had absolutely everything. He'd stolen so much gold from his brother Kuvera. He had Lanka, a city of gold. But he wasn't satisfied. He had to go and grab something that wasn't his, Mother Sita. He thought, here's something for my enjoyment. I'll take Mother Sita. Others tried to tell him, don't do this. Jatayu tried to warn him, you fool, what are you doing? But still, when you're addicted to that mood of absorption, enjoyment, you'll stop at nothing. And so it just expands our desires. So we are learning how to be very focused. These pilgrimages that we read about are very healthy. Healthy for a person's spiritual life. Lord Balaram went on pilgrimage. He toured all these places. He went to Madurai as well. Srila Prabhupada traveled there. Lord Chaitanya is traveling there. And what is the mood of pilgrimage? The mood of pilgrimage isn't really a sightseeing tour. It is not that you go there, marvel at the architecture, go to a nice restaurant, have a 5-course meal, sit on the lawn, eat some ice cream, watch some movies in the TV in your room. Anytime now the Lord will appear. Sri Sri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai. So that's not really the mood of a pilgrimage. That's more of a holiday. That's a Butlin-style holiday or a package tour. Here there's something special. The mood of the devotees. And the mood of the devotees we understand from the behavior of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In this pilgrimage, Mahaprabhu meets many great persons. He goes to Rameshwar, he picks up some literature, he comes back, he visits the Adi Keshav temple, he extracts the Brahma Samhita from there, which is a great work of devotion about Lord Krishna, which states his position as the Supreme Lord, the original Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachidananda Vikraha Anadir Adir Govinda Saravakarana Karanam. We understand Krishna consciousness. We have a chance when we go on these pilgrimages to meditate on Sri Krishna. And even if we cannot travel to a particular place, there are many places are mentioned here, and there are many others also in other parts, places important like Vrindavan, Mayapur. Here we are also in a place of pilgrimage. This place, this temple, any temple of the Lord is a place of pilgrimage. And here it has special significance because Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda are here. It's a place of pilgrimage for many in the country, definitely. One of the two tirthas where Srila Prabhupada established their Lordship Sri Sri Radha Landanishwara and Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda in the UK specifically. And so what can we do while we're here? We can actually demonstrate and embody the same principle of deep absorption that we read about of these great acharyas. King Kulashekar was one of the Alwars. These are 12 great personalities who are considered to be the manifestations of the paraphernalia of the Lord. That's a very interesting concept. It's somewhat of an alien concept to us, because here in this world, we see an object, we see a board, we see a chamara, a peacock fan, and we offer all these items to Srila Prabhupada or to the deities in service. But in the spiritual world and in the spiritual realm, every item is a living entity. Every energy is a person. So there is consciousness at every step. Every piece of stone is a living item. So we have to alter the physics with which we think we're working. These entities, the paraphernalia of the Lord, are entities, living entities who give pleasure to the Lord. And they're very competent and cognizant. And therefore, that paraphernalia has manifested as these alwars. And their nature is by nature to serve the Lord. So you can see how it ties in with the mood of King Kulashekara and all these other great persons. Now why I mention this? Because here in this holy place, here at Bhaktivedanta Manor, we are also learning to do the same. We may not be in that category of being directly considered to be an item of pleasure for the Lord. But the Lord is nevertheless very pleased to see us. He's very pleased to see that devotees have made some attempt to come towards him. It's very nice to see here in this audience, in the temple room today, devotees who are here on the Be a Monk Challenge course. How many of you are there? Can you raise your hands? Yes, many of you. Haribo. Yes, it is worthy of applause. Because you have undertaken this challenge, you have gone through the austerity of setting aside the regular bodily considerations, which is not easy. Maybe experiencing a few bodily austerities yourselves, living here in the ashram, maybe with some snoring episodes and all sorts of other entertainment which takes place in the ashram. It is a great step. It is a great attempt that indicates to Krishna that you have started a pilgrimage of some kind. It is a step on a pilgrimage into the Lord's abode, into the environment where the Lord's activities and the Lord's agenda are in the atmosphere. That's the purpose of this temple. When you come into the temple room even, the atmosphere is one of Vrindavan, is one of Vaikuntha, is one where the Lord is worshipped. There's always a pujari there, offering worship to the Lord. The Lord is bathed twice a day. He's dressed twice a day. He's a person. He's treated with great care, just as a person. He's offered tasty items to eat 6 times a day. That's not bad, is it? 6 times a day for his pleasure. And in this way, what we're doing is we are developing our connection with the Lord. We simultaneously, while we're here in the temple, we practice Vaidhi Sadhana, a very, very important composition of spiritual practices which very quickly purify us. We come into the temple, we come into this world with a lot of baggage, thoughts, preconceptions, habits, ideas, desires for the future, which are not all healthy. And when we come here, we have the opportunity and the chance to purify ourselves. Purify ourselves and enliven us in service to Sri Krishna. So we can take a great deal of example and a great deal of inspiration from persons like Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva himself is situated in pure Krishna consciousness. It said, Satvam Vishuddham Vasudeva Shabditam Yadiyate Tatra Pumana Pavrita Satve Chatasmin Bhagavan Vasudevo Yadoksha Jome Namasa Vidiyate. Lord Shiva himself explains that I am situated in pure Krishna consciousness, in a state of Shuddha Sattva, pure goodness, within which state Vasudev can manifest, in that clear water-like state of Vasudev consciousness, Shuddha Sattva, which is transcendental to the modes of goodness, passion and ignorance. In that state, the Lord himself can manifest. And this is what Lord Shiva does all day long. He's in that constant meditation. So we have these great examples. There is so much more that could be said about each one of these personalities and places here, even today. But I'll stop for now, and I'll ask if there are any questions or comments. Yes, Prabhuji?
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you for your class. I just had one question. There was like a brief... I guess, description on how we should like take care of the body. Of course, not be so concerned with it, but take care of it so that we don't get sick. We can be strong in our devotional service.
Yeah.
And you mentioned about the stress and emotional dealings that come with a material body and so how that can present itself in the physical. But I guess my question is about the stress and emotional issues that are maybe caused by intense devotional service. Sometimes devotees, maybe they are that they're being too ambitious. And then this can actually manifest itself in their physical body. Mm. So is it different than, is it different, you know, should we take a step back or like what should we do when we feel maybe our seva is maybe a bit too intense at times?
Mm. It's an interesting question. As a general rule and in my observation, it rarely happens that too much devotion causes you any mental or physical issues. I would say it practically never happens. Rather, what actually can happen is that when service or activities are performed without a full and clear devotional connection, by which I mean we may be doing a certain service or a certain activity, but we're not conscious how that activity is connected to the pleasure of the Lord, or how our supply of service and effort is actually part of an overall picture of a wholesome program of progress, then what can happen is sometimes those activities can get out of balance. If we're actually fully absorbed in the Lord, thinking of his name, fame, form, qualities while we're engaged in a service, that itself acts as a protective barrier and actually allows our devotion to be completely protected and nourished while it is taking place. But when something is done a little randomly, perhaps, or without careful consideration and planning, then there is a chance that we may cause some disruption to ourselves or to others. Ultimately, there isn't any loss, really, because the Lord sees that this person was even prepared to sacrifice his body and mind. And actually, as we read about these great acharyas, the Alwars, the six Goswamis, that's one thing they did continuously. Completely neglected their bodily needs. They hardly ate, they hardly slept. They would be in the blazing sun meditating. They would be doing things that are inconceivable to us. Sometimes they would fast. The Srimad Bhagavatam is full of episodes of persons who fasted, who underwent great physical austerities just so that they could serve and serve and serve. Ultimately, it's the devotion that is the real product of all of these efforts and austerities. Mahaprabhu was actually personally very happy when he saw his disciples engaged in great austerities. He was extremely happy to see the personal difficulties that the Goswamis undertook in their exclusive service to him. So therefore, what it comes down to is having a healthy, wholesome program of sadhana under the guidance of senior devotees. When that part is missing, we may be encouraged or enthused by persons who may not be senior, or who may just whimsically give us a prescription to follow. Well, the effect of that could be the same as a prescription given by someone who thinks they're a doctor but isn't. You know, if your best friend asks you for advice, and or the other way around, you go to your best friend and you say, "I've got a rash on my hand here. Can you help deal with it? What do you suggest I do?" And your friend gives you some suggestions. You know, stick this lotion on it, stick some surgical spirit on it, put chamomile on it, dunk it in boiling water, put some ice on it. Maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't take their advice too seriously. Probably better to go and see a doctor, a competent person. So you may be encouraged or advised to do a program of activities by others who may not necessarily have much experience. Experience is gained over time. And when someone practices devotional service over a number of years, decades actually, That is when you can say they have a certain maturity in order to be able to anticipate the needs and understand the type of progress that different people can make. And this is where there's some skill required. Because some people need to be thrown right into the deep end, depending on their nature. Straight in the deep end, paddle around, survive, engage in so much devotional service that your mind, everything else disappears from your mind. That's what some people need. Others need a different approach. Others need the floats. Others need to gently be lowered into the steps in the shallow end, and then to start treading a little water, to start practicing something of the items of devotional service, to understand the philosophy. Each of those persons is equally valuable. And so in a group, we may see some people who, as a result of their previous devotional activities, may be quite accelerated in their practice. We should not let that dishearten us at all. We should stick to the level we are at. And we should seek guidance, something that is specific for us at our particular level. So what is a troublesome or a stressful situation for one person is accepted as a situation of great spiritual ecstasy, even if there may be stress by someone else. And so we have Mother Yashoda, who is a great example of this. So if you think that if you have the chance to be in Vatsalya Rasa with Krishna, you become the parent of Krishna, that's the greatest source of joy. You think, okay, I can give Krishna a cuddle. Yes, you can. But you'll be doing a few other things as well which you hadn't bargained for. Your heart will practically stop every time Krishna does some mischief, or a cart collapses over him, or a Trinavarta demon comes and carries him off, or he drowns. What will you do? Or he enters the mouth of Agasur, and you're faced with the loss of your son? What will you? This is the state of Mother Yashoda. She's in constant anxiety that Krishna is going to be captured, kidnapped, killed. He's going to hurt himself on the thorns, on the pebbles. He keeps doing naughty things himself. He keeps going to other people's houses and stealing their butter. Imagine, this is no stress-free zone for Mother Yashoda. And she's in constant anxiety over Krishna, but she's also experiencing the greatest of ecstasy. And that's something we can't fully understand here, because in the material world, stress means trouble. Stress means something painful. So yes, that other aspect of your question, there is an element of engagement which may seem stressful, may have some of the symptoms of stress, but the result of which is completely different and actually simply just nourishes us and encourages us to serve more. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, did you?
From a spiritual perspective, not like who you are born to.
What the difference is?
Yeah, so like not in a physical manner. So if I'm born to Brahman parents, yes, you will categorically be called Brahman or Vaishnava. But what's the spiritual difference in the context of what Bhagavad Gita describes?
Yes. So there are four classes, four orders in society, four ashrams and four varanas. And these are the varanas, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Shudra. And they are different occupations in one sense. And the occupation is performed according to one's trait also, according to one's mental tendencies. And largely those run in families. And at least in the past, they would run in families. These days, a lot of the population is what is called Varana Sankara. And this was one of the concerns of Arjuna in the Gita, in the first chapter, that he said, when there is a dharma bhibhavat krishna pradushyanti kulastriya stri shudushta suvarshnaya jayate varna sankara sankaro narakayeva kulagnanam kulasya, that when the actual protection of women in society fails, then a type of population arises which is called varna sankara. And this population is mixed population. They don't really know what they are. They're misled by multiple influences because they no longer have a tradition of proper growth and care within their own tradition. Amongst the Shudras, there are family traditions for specific skills where knowledge is passed down through art, through craft, through different things. For Vaishyas, the art of making money is something that's passed down. The skill of looking after cows, mercantile trade, it's passed down through the families. For Kshatriyas, the young princes would be trained within the kingdom how to become kings, how to actually deal with politics, how to tax the citizens legitimately, not illegitimately. They would learn all this simply by being in that environment. And then the Brahmanas, through strict training by the Brahmana parents and then in the Gurukul, which was meant to be a place of austerity, really. Brahmachari Gurukule Vasandantam Guror Hitam. That's the occupation for a young brahmachari of the Brahmana, Kshatriya or Vaishya classes. They would go to Gurukul to learn different things. As a result of all of those purifications, each of those varanas has to undergo great training. And therefore they learn their trade. Now, the brahmanas are supposed to be administering spiritual principles to society. And so in society, the brahmanas are supposed to be encouraging the kings, like this was King Kulashekhar. But we read in the passage how he maintained a group of brahmanas. And he would constantly be seeking spiritual counsel from them. This is ideally how it's meant to work. You have a brahmana head who guides the kshatriyas. The brahmanas have no interest in ruling or managing. They're not interested in becoming the prime minister or becoming the president or anything like that, or the king. But they are advisors to persons who are in those roles. Now, a person in that role, like a kshatriya, is a Vaishnav. It would be wrong for him to call himself a brahmana, because brahmana means certain things. Right? Patan, patan, yajan, yajan, dana, pratikraha. These are the traits of a brahmana. But he can call himself a Vaishnav if he follows and conducts the affairs of a state in accordance with the advice given by the Vaishnav brahmanas. Similarly, a Vaishya can be a Vaishnav, a follower of Lord Vishnu, if they conduct their activities, if they pay their taxes correctly to the legitimate king, if they worship Lord Krishna. When Krishna appeared, he chose a Vaishya setting, right? The cowherd folk. He chose village life to be part of. Krishna is completely transcendental to all these classifications. He also acted as a Kshatriya in Mathura, well, in Dwarka specifically. He was the king there. He never claimed to be a Brahmana. He didn't do that because for Krishna to serve the lotus feet of the Brahmanas is the greatest benediction he considers for himself. And he's the Supreme Lord. The Brahmanas are all bending down, offering him their obeisances on a daily basis, trying to serve him. But he considers that my Brahmanas are so dear that I will do anything for them. So there is a distinction. A Vaishnav is a follower of Vishnu. In terms of a category, it could be considered that a Vaishnav is higher than and transcendental to any of these classifications. The classifications of Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra, even Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyas, Naham Vipra na cha Narapatira, Naapi Vaishya na Shudra, Naham Varni na cha Grihapatira na Manastoya Tirva, Intu Pradhyan Nikhila Paramananda, Purnam Ritabder, Gopi Bhartu, Pada Kamalayor, Das, Das, and Udas. We offer this prayer before we engage in worship or seva, that I'm not a Brahmachari, I'm not a Vanaprastha, I'm not a guru, I'm not a grihastha, I'm not a sannyasi. I'm das, das, anudas. I'm a servant of the servant of the servant of the Lord. That is a real Vaishnav mentality. And so Krishna respects the brahmanas. He always encourages that class. And some brahmanas, well, brahmanas are all supposed to be Vaishnav brahmanas. And when they are, that's highly successful and exemplary for them. But definitely it's not the case that just birth alone, especially in today's day and age, indicates qualities. In the past it was the case that even if someone was born into a Brahmana family, they couldn't help but acquire certain Brahminical traits. But these days it's very much difficult because our training, practically since the moment we are born, involves so much contamination from all directions. And so the samskaras are not provided. It is said clearly, yasya lakshanam proktam tattaneva vinirdishet that one should be accepted according to the qualities and characteristics. Yasya yal lakshana proktam, according to the lakshana, according to the manifested symptoms or traits that a person develops. Now, one of Prabhupada's interesting missionary aspects was to really apply this verse and to try to create amongst society a class of brahmanas, genuine brahmanas, because by and large they've all disappeared. Brahmanas are generally now no better than businessmen. They conduct their puja on the basis of receiving some fee or payment. Well, that's not okay for brahmanas. They're not supposed to receive a fee or payment for services. They're not supposed to conduct katha charging a fee. It's not meant to happen. Prabhupada spoke strongly against this type of tendency that has now arisen in Kali Yuga. It is naturally a case that there's supposed to be reciprocation. Dana pratigraha, yes. Brahmana is supposed to receive dana, donations, but they're also supposed to give knowledge, spiritual knowledge, which is untainted and pure. So we have an interesting situation in this world where people, some groups, consider themselves to be elevated just by their birthright. Others are envious of that, and therefore they consider them to be insignificant and themselves to be very important. We have to give up both of these envious tendencies. That the Lord has put each person in a particular position according to their qualities, according to their karma. And if someone is in a higher position than us, we offer them respect. We certainly do not follow the propagation of envy that goes on in politics, where everyone has to be reduced down to the same equal, lowest common denominator standard. I'm envious because someone is phenomenally rich. Therefore, I will do something to tax them to death and bring them down to my level so that I can be more comfortable that no one is better off than me. This is one political agenda often played out. And then you have the rich who are thinking, I must acquire as much as possible, even at the expense of all those below me who are struggling. So these are all examples of the types of nonsense that go on in society today. So therefore, devotees neither support the right-wing mentality nor the left-wing mentality. Both are seriously flawed in today's day and age. Rather, we support something with Krishna at the center, something that promotes God, Krishna. And you can be rich, you can be poor, you can be mediocre, you can be a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, but you can be a servant of the Lord. And in that position, when you act in your position, you will derive great benefit. Absolutely every single person is welcome here in ISKCON. And ISKCON has a specific duty to impart Brahminical culture to people. So whether one engages in a trade as a Shudra or as a Vaishya, they should try and do so with Brahminical principles, which are instructed through classes, through discussions, through Sangha, through devotee association. So there is a difference and a hierarchy because they're dealing with different concepts. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, on a lengthy basis, had these debates, Brahman or Vaishnava. Those are recorded. Thank you. Yes? Yeah, if you can give her the mic.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. So I understand that, following on what you said about ISKCON accepts anyone and everyone. Mm-hmm. What if one is attracted to the principles of Krishna consciousness and Vaishnavism, and surely that relates to, you know, their past devotional credits, but they're born into a family that isn't, like, they're not Vaishnavs. Mm-hmm. And so it relates to, in your class you were saying, when we're in the world, we're engaged with matters of our body and our mind, as well as our extended bodies, other people, meaning that we care about those people. But what happens when those people are atheistic, or they conform to, or they follow, or we want to worship an impersonal form of the Lord? Mm. Being close to that belief has an impact on, you know, your mindset, especially if you're very attracted to worshipping a personal form. What would you say about someone in that position?
Yes. Well, the first thing is, be reassured that that is a very common position that people are in. It is extremely common. In fact, I suspect most people in this room have experienced some resistance from their families, friends, when they decided to take more seriously the worship of the Lord. Sometimes as a result of tradition, families, especially from a Hindu tradition, are happy to engage the family in worship of the Lord, but not too much. Janmashtami is okay. Ramnami is okay. Turn up on a Sunday every now and then at the manor. But don't get too involved with it. Because after all, you know, this is for retirement. Once you're 70, once you're 80, once your teeth have fallen out, once you can barely walk, that's the time to be doing devotion. Right now the time is for enjoyment. Build your career. Well, there's actually no conflict. So people will propagate that there's a conflict or a contradiction between becoming a devotee and being materially successful. There's actually no conflict. We have people in our congregation who have 12, 13 A stars in their exams. They chant every day. They come to the temple. They serve. They worship the Lord. There is no contradiction. It is only a contradiction in the minds of those around us. We also have to be a little sensible, because one reality of this world is that we can't change the minds of people around us. So many have tried. It typically doesn't happen. Especially when you're dealing with your parents. They're not going to listen really to anything you say. They've been seeing you walking around in nappies and, you know, vomiting and screaming and shouting and ranting and raving and all sorts of other stuff. They fundamentally cannot take you too seriously. And other relatives are like that too. So you don't follow a program of expecting them to change. So then we have to learn how to actually survive in such an environment and remain enthused. And therefore we need to ask for the mercy of Prahlad Maharaj. Because whatever situation you're describing, for Prahlad Maharaj it was dozens of times worse. He was in a family of real demoniac persons. His father was practically like a Rakshasa, or at least some of their associates were Rakshasas. He was sent to the best demon school where he could learn how to exploit, how to conquer, how to divide and rule. Best teachers, everything was nicely arranged for him. Sandhya and Amarka were there. They knew Vedic scriptures also. And they thought they were giving the boys a nice education. Well, Prahlad Maharaj, you know, when he was questioned by his father said to him, "My dear boy," and he sat him on his lap and affectionately patted him, and he said, "My dear boy, tell me what you learnt in school today." And Prahlad Maharaj said, "Shravanam kirtanam vishnu smaranam pada sevanam archanam vandanam dasyam sakyam atma nivedanam iti pum sarpita vishnu bhaktischenna valakshana kriyeta bhagavati adha tanmanye dhita muttamam." He says, "Shravanam kirtanam vishnu smaranam pada sevanam." This is what a sensible person should do in their life. Hear about the Lord, chant the Lord's glories, remember the Lord, engage in service to Him. Think of the Lord as a friend and surrender atma nivedanam, our entire existence to Him. And anyone who follows this path, these nine processes of devotional service, is a great devotee of the Lord and makes their life successful. And you know what his father did? He flew into a rage. He threw him off his lap, started ranting and raving, brought the teachers along and said, "What have you been teaching my boy? Is this what you taught him?" And the teacher said, no, we didn't do anything. We're just teaching him all the subjects you told us to teach him, how to rape, how to pillage, how to steal, how to conquer, how to extract money. We did that. We don't know where he gets this from." And his father said to him, "Where do you get all this from?" He says, "I get this from the same place that you get your strength, from Vishnu." His father said, "Who is Vishnu?" And to put it mildly, he went mad. And then he tried to kill Prahlad in so many ways. And this was played out over a number of years. So whatever situation we have, where the parents or the relatives might say, they might whinge at us for going to the temple again, or for going to some Pandavasena program, or doing something at university, or, you know, joining the KC SOC at university, or turning up at Janmashtami and offering some service. Just kind of deal with it. It's kind of minor compared to what Prahlad Maharaj had to go through. It's one of the little entertaining challenges along the way. And you'll see what happens after some time, that those persons actually realize that in their family they have a treasure. Somehow they actually have a valuable jewel in their family, in the form of a person who sticks to the process of devotional service. Whether they're atheistic, from a different spiritual path, have no interest in religion whatsoever, or are actively hedonistic or troublesome, they will notice benefits in their life. They may go through the entire life still maintaining animosity, but it is my experience that over time, the majority of relatives and parents start to see that here is a person who has chosen a noble path in life. And as I said, there's no contradiction or conflict between having a healthy, happy material life and having spiritual life. So we shouldn't have any doubts in that regard either. Any connection we have with Krishna in our life can only be auspicious in all aspects. We just keep the onward march going. Is that okay? Yes, yes. Yes, Prabhuji first and then Prayojan Prabhu. If you can send the mic.
Hi, Hare Krishna Prabhu. I just want to say, amazing class. Honestly, mind-blowing. So many questions I've had this week, you've actually answered them organically through the class. It was tied to the last question, but an earlier statement, you said that most of us in this room or watching live in the material world, and obviously are getting closer, you know, closer to different stages of our devotional journey.
Yes.
And it's just a constant, you know, navigation process in the terms of the statement of, you know, detach from the attachment of the material activities, accomplishments, etc. We have responsibilities, family, jobs, businesses, etc. So I've got my own awareness, understanding and tools, you know, that I've developed through conversations with people like yourself and other devotees and what I've learned. But yeah, I'd love to hear your advice on how to navigate, be responsible, you know, and practice those material activities, but detach from the attachment from those material activities that takes you away from your connection to your soul and Krishna.
Yes, well, that's a big topic, but it is precisely why Lord Krishna spoke chapters 3 and 5 of the Gita. In chapter 2, Krishna had given a sort of a condensed summary of everything. And it's called the Contents of the Gita Summarize. And in that, he had spoken about the need to be detached from work, but he'd also encouraged Arjun to fight. So Arjun was confused. And he said, on the one hand, you're telling me not to do stuff. On the other hand, you're telling me to fight. How do we reconcile these? And so then Krishna spoke. Chapters 3, then chapter 4 is transcendental knowledge. Chapter 5 continues that theme of action in Krishna consciousness. And it's all techniques of how we can work within this world, do our duties, but connect them to Krishna. There are many, many points that we could raise on this. Ultimately, our activities, I'll mention one verse from the Bhagavatam, Ata pumbir dvijashreshta varnashrama vibhagasaha swanushtitasya dharmasya samsiddhir haritoshanam. All our efforts in this world, whether they're in the four divisions of varna and ashram, they should be done with the purpose or the desire, Sri Haritoshanam, to please the Supreme Lord. So that means we have to think how any activity that we perform can actually please the Lord. If we are working, we're earning money. One excellent way to detach ourselves in that situation is to actually donate voluntarily some aspects of the fruits of our labor. In the Gita, an entire yoga ladder is hinted at and described, right from a karmakand basis to a sakam karma level, the nishkam karma, then higher jnana yoga, pure bhakti yoga, different stages by which one, exhibits increasing detachment and surrender to the Lord at each stage. So the Sakam Karma Yoga is a good level for most people, practically in the situation you described. That we are working, we're attached. One thing we should do is give some of the fruits of that attachment directly for Krishna conscious purposes. Directly offer something for the Lord, for His seva. That is one way that you will develop the habit of not being so greedily attached to wealth. The moment we do that, that wealth is actually purified. Now this is just one item connected to wealth. Your time, your words, your actions, your thoughts, your deed, anything you possess can all be connected to the Lord. With your words, you can glorify the Lord. If you have an opportunity to say something about the Lord to maybe colleagues or persons, you may be able to explain it. You may be able to say, oh, I'm going to go on a pilgrimage this year. I'm going to visit certain special places. And then the thought may come. They may ask you, where are you going? And you can say, I'm going to Vrindavan, the birthplace of Lord Krishna. I'm going to go to this place, that place, to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's place. And they'll ask, who's that? Talk about Krishna whenever you can. Jare deko tahakare tarakahi Krishna upadesh. Whoever you see, whoever you meet, tell them about Krishna. Without deeds, you could help someone. Devotees are naturally kind. We can help someone. And over time, they may see that you are actually of good character. And they will naturally respect then what you have to say. So we have to detach ourselves by practically removing that attachment. We have to detach ourselves by understanding the purpose for why we are doing things. We are, as the Bhagavatam advises, we should maintain the body. But nothing else should really be the goal of our works. We should conduct our activities for the purpose of maintaining the body. And then we should engage maximum time in Shrinvatam Swakata Krishna, Punya Shravana Kirtanaha. We can also learn how to minimize all the material things that we do. We often spend far too much time on them, just because we don't really have anything else to do. But now, when you actually have something else, imagine now you have the chance to chant around, to cook a nice offering. And this is something your wife at home, the family, fiancé can all participate in. Produce something nice for the Lord, offer it. That will be actually far more satisfying than anything else you could probably do in that time. So there are many, many tips and tricks. But we can understand from the Gita the principle of action in inaction, and inaction in action. One who knows that sees things as they are. And that is a bit of a trick. But it has Krishna at the center, and it has a detachment from matter, but a simultaneous attraction to Krishna. Because ultimately, the only way we can give up something less desirable is by attaching ourselves to something more desirable. And so if we just attach ourselves to the beautiful lotus feet of Sri Krishna and His service, there really is nothing else in this world that comes close to the beauty of the Lord. It's only after some time that we will really appreciate that. Is that okay? Thank you. So, Prayojan Prabhu?
Thank you. Hare Krishna.
I'll do my best to paraphrase a quote from Prabhupada in his Transcendental Calendar. It's based on a letter from Jayapataka Swami. And he says about the secret of surrendering to Krishna is that such a surrendered soul sees that everything is part of Krishna's plan. No matter what I'm doing now, I'm meant to be doing. So, let me do it with my... let me become absorbed in that service. Let all other considerations be forgotten. And let me become... and our only motivation is actually Krishna's alone pleasure. Let all other considerations be forgotten. So in fact, it's a relative position to say that if you see that actually Krishna's in control of your life already, that whatever position you're in now, it's meant to be, and you make the most of it, but at the same time, You seek advice, you seek help through others who you can respect. So the secret of surrender, we become absorbed in what we're doing for Krishna's alone pleasure. That is my only motive.
Thank you. Thank you. Any final question? Okay. Okay, Prabhuji. Yeah, that'd be the last one.
Hello, Hare Krishna Prabhu. Thank you for your lecture, and really enjoyed the pastimes of Lord Ram as well in relation to the king. That was very nicely told. Enjoyed that. So I have a question regarding Varna Dharma again.
On Varnashram Dharma?
Yeah, specifically, so in the 18th chapter, in 47th verse, Krishna says, you know, Svabhava Niyatam Karma Gurvan Napanoti Kilbisham, which means duties prescribed according to one's nature are never affected by sinful reactions. Mm. How do we determine our Svabhava? And is Swabhava something that's already kind of manifest right now? You can kind of, with some symptoms of your activities, determine it? Or is it after purification and after many years of sadhana, can you actually determine your actual Swabhava and thereby determine which varna you're meant to be in?
Yes, without getting too much into detail on this, it's both actually. In that context, when a Swabhava is mentioned, that one should know one's nature, that is referring to one's material nature. Arjuna is a warrior. This is specifically within that context, this is being spoken to him. And Arjuna has already explained in the past how he doesn't want the sinful reactions of having to kill his own kinsman in the fight. So this verse is specifically directed at Krishna, that your nature is a warrior. You're a warrior, you're a fighter. You're supposed to fight. If you conduct your activities as a fighter legitimately, according to the rules of religion, your actions will not incur sin for you. Now that there is another swabhav, which is our eternal swarup, or our eternal position in connection with Krishna. And that is realized after many, many years of practice, after complete perfection, after we've transcended completely the world. But it is useful to know what is our trait, what is our nature. Do we, by nature, are we more a Brahmin by nature? Are we more a Kshatriya, a Vaishya, or a Shudra? Often, you will have a sense of this after a certain number of years, you know. You will know what your, say by about 20, most people have kind of figured out where their skills or interests lie. And it's not that society totally rejects the idea of different natures and different people, because, you know, in school you choose subjects, you probably have careers advice, you probably decided to choose a certain career if you're technically minded or something more artistic or something more humanities related. It does depend on your nature. So you'll have from these hints certain ideas of what your duty is. And then you basically act in that duty and perform the requirements of that duty. Over time, through discussion with devotees, you learn how to purify that action also. How you can engage in a particular service, but give it a little bit of purity. Do it in a certain way that you will actually simultaneously benefit those around you and also purify your efforts themselves. And then eventually, yes, as after some extended time in Krishna consciousness, which can be a moment also, depending on the intensity of our absorption, literally can be a moment. We can be situated in our original Swabhav also. So we just have to keep going. We have to keep the holy name at the core of our activities, because that is the one disruptive ingredient that can totally disrupt any obstacles or any hang-ups or resistances that are preventing us going forward in spiritual life. We just try practicing, chanting the holy name. That would be of great benefit to us. Actually, the holy name is a very fundamental characteristic. And we have actually coming up now a very important month, the month of Purushottam, starting on on Tuesday, the 18th. For the next month, I think till 16th of August. And every evening we've arranged a program here in the temple room to replace the normal Bhagavad Gita class, where we'll have a bhajan at the beginning from 5:45, Then there'll be a special talk on the holy name for the next half an hour. Different aspects of the holy name, different tips and tricks to help us concentrate. We'll meditate on some of the great personalities like Haridas Thakur, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who really exemplified the chanting of the holy names. And then we'll actually do a japa session for the next half an hour till the Gaur Aarti begins at 7. So it's designed to be a reflection of the morning program. But there'll be a special focus on japa for this entire month. So I strongly encourage you to come and attend that. It'll be a very nice sandwich. You have your morning nourishment, and then this will be a very nice evening nourishment for everyone as well. And we're hoping especially the devotees, those aspiring to become serious in their spiritual lives, will actually take advantage of this. Thank you. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.